This is a special live edition of Main Street. I'm Ann Ulquist, director of radio, and I'm joined by Danielle Webster, one of our longtime reporters at Prairie Public. And Danielle, you just came running from the...
Can you hear I'm still out of breath? Yeah.
From the downtown. We've got time. We've got time. You and I both spent the morning and now half the afternoon. You've just come running from the federal courthouse from the sentencing hearing of former state senator Ray Holmberg. And just as a reminder, Holmberg signed a plea agreement last September, which convicted him on one count of intent to traveling to have sex with a minor. So the sentencing hearing, he's been incarcerated in Minnesota since November 1st.
Yes.
And so today was the first time, really, that the public has seen him since he was incarcerated. And so we saw him today. You're familiar with a lot of the who's who in North Dakota. I still feel like I saw someone who I later found out was the attorney general. I just remember looking at him. I thought, wow, like Henry Fonda could have played him in a movie or something. You know, I'm still learning who the power brokers are. So give us a sense of the room at the courthouse.
So lots of journalists were there. We did find later in the afternoon there were a couple of, victims or witnesses who wanted to give impact statements that were there. And then kind of a who's who, you know, of, you know, a couple of politicians I saw.
Including the attorney general.
Yes, the attorney general was there, Drew Wrigley. The courtroom, it was in courtroom one of the federal courthouse downtown Fargo. And the presiding judge is Peter Welty. The prosecution was U.S. She's the acting U.S. attorney, Jennifer Poole, presenting the case on behalf of the United States. And then sitting next to her was he's a special agent with Homeland Security, Dan Cassetta. And Ray Holmberg was seated, you know, on the opposite side of the courtroom. He's dressed in the orange, you know, detention jumpsuit. And his attorney was there, Mark Fries. And then, of course, you know, yeah, journalists everywhere. Ann and I were kind of tucked away in the corner in the back and
a few other
taking it all in.
Journalists as well. You know, I do want to make sure I just give a cautionary note. You and I were taking copious notes. We are going to quote directly from the arguments that we heard from both the U.S. attorney as well as the defense attorney and the victim impact statements. So just be aware that as we are quoting things, some of the quotes may be sexually explicit and graphic in nature and disturbing. So just an FYI.
Absolutely.
As we move through this. So, you know, one of the things that I did that I was struck by was the number of exhibits when acting U.S. Attorney Poole introduced it. Mm-hmm. There were 9 of them.
Yeah.
And that's when I think I knew, Danielle, we would be in for a long haul.
Yes.
And on my way out, I did actually run into a marshal on my way back to the station. And I did ask him, I said, this is, because we're now going on hour 5.
Right.
5.5 hours, because it started at 9:30 this morning. And he said, I've never seen anything like this. He said, maybe they go for 2 hours.
Yeah.
But this is extremely unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think acting U.S. Attorney Jennifer Poole, when she said there were going to be 9 exhibits, I think that was when I realized that this was going to be a long day.
Yes,
as well.
It's still a long day.
Well, let's go into their primary witnesses, part of the sentencing hearing, which was Special Agent Dan Cassetta. And I even remarked to you, man, that man has nice hair. And it was, and I sort of learned why. It's because he's involved in undercover operations. He was involved in an undercover operation to investigate Ray Holmberg as part of this investigation. So why don't we just take a step back and just kind of do the timeline about how this whole thing got started.
Yes. So how we got into this this sentencing, how we got to today, basically this started with a person who was associated with Ray Holmberg, a man by the name of Nicholas Morgan DeRozier. He had ties to Holmberg. He, you know, he was a landscaper and he had been working on a number of projects, you know, on the property and whatnot. A search warrant executed had found images and communications between DeRozier and Holmberg, and that started the investigation into him that resulted in the search warrant being executed. That search warrant, that specific one, was November 17th, 2021, of Holmberg's home. And we want to get into a little bit of, you know, what they found. And I'm kind of like just looking at my notes here, which are a disaster. Let me just
so just for the edification of our audience here, recording is not allowed in the courtroom.
No.
So, I mean, well, I think you could bring in your recording equipment, Daniel, but you couldn't actually tape anything.
No.
And if they saw a phone come out, the bailiffs would get a little grumpy.
Yeah, they didn't even want you touching your phone.
Yeah.
So the phone was in the pockets.
Yeah, and I will say, just being in a room where justice is being, you know, where adjudication is happening, it felt very sacred.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ritual of justice.
Let's see here. DeRozier was arrested. Holmberg, they were texting from jail about ongoing things. It's just really kind of hard to get into the actual details of it.
So the warrant, they execute the search warrant for Nick Morgan DeRozier, and that's how Ray Holmberg gets implicated in this. They found child sex abuse images on Nick Morgan DeRozier's devices.
Yep.
And he was sentenced last May to 40 years.
Yes.
Yeah. So he was found guilty and sentenced in May and fined some amount of money.
I think, and how it went down was, so I mean, Ray Holmberg, you know, after this search warrant of his home and his things were taken and looked through, when he was later questioned, you know, just right after that, I mean, it was remarked upon on both sides about just how forthright he was. He admitted to a lot of stuff. He was like, "Yep, that was there. Yep, I was talking to him. This is what we were talking about." It was a pretty dramatic moment for me, like what I was watching, when they described how, you know, he doesn't have his phone anymore after he's leaving, you know, from this questioning, but he gets a burner phone and he calls his friend, Wayne Stengem, who is the former Attorney General of North Dakota, who actually passed away a few months after that, and he did not pick up the phone. But he left him a voicemail, and just basically to the effect of, you know, I'm in big trouble, and give me a call.
And that is directly from the acting U.S. Attorney's Jennifer Poole, her questioning of Special Agent Dan Cassetta.
Yes.
That is a direct quote from the witness giving the testimony the day after the search warrant was executed. So November 18th, 2021, they had the evidence that that Ray Holmberg had called Wayne Stengem and left a voicemail that said, "I'm calling from a burner phone. I'm in big trouble."
Yes. So then DeRozier was indicted in 2022. He was sentenced to 40 years. This was last year in May for having those child sex abuse images. And so that part of the story ends there. But the investigation into Holmberg continued. So
And some of this had to do with funds, right? And this was something that the defense picked up on as well when they cross-examined and then when they made their case and criticized the media, actually, for making it sound like the North Dakota legislature had given these funds directly to Ray Holmberg and that he had used them to travel to Europe, to Prague specifically. And that he had used them. And the defense attorney was very specific that the North Dakota legislature had given the funds to private entities, and that money is the money that Ray Holmberg had been given and had used to travel to Prague.
And I think the optics of it being problematic, probably where the media runs from it, is, of course, you know, Ray Holmberg as a senior member of the
chair of the Appropriations Committee.
The chair of the Appropriations Committee, who, you know, that's the committee that allocates all the money. You know, I mean, obviously the legislature decides where the money is going to go, but the Appropriations Committee has the most, you know, and they're going to allocate. So it just didn't look good, I guess, is the point there. And then, of course, there were a lot of, you know, the details of, you know, what he was involved in doing. You know, a lot of the things, and the defense attorney did make the point many times, You know, there's a lot of talk about seemingly consensual relationships with young men who were of legal age, which is true. And he pointed out, you know, it's not a crime to have these relationships, men that are 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. Nicholas DeRozier had employees. They were, you know, and they were referred to by, you know, just their initials throughout the, you know, the proceedings today. And, you know, how they were kind of worked, you know, into the mix. Like, they were tapped for, you know, I would like these landscaping services. Can you, you know, do this sexual service, you know?
The way Special Agent Dan Cassetta put it, tit for tat.
Yeah.
That was something that he said in his mm-hmm. in his testimony, mm-hmm. And he corrected the defense attorney when he said, "You said they were force," and he said, "No, I didn't say they were force.
Yes.
It was tit for tat."
And it kind of, I think that what they were trying to show there is, I mean, and not necessarily like, "Hey, look at all this illegal stuff that was happening," because that's not necessarily illegal, but it does show an imbalance of power. I mean, this is a person that's employing you to do a job. This is the person that he's working for and whatnot, and it kind of establishes the pattern of not so on the up and up type of behavior. And then when you get into, you know, the allegations, or I guess, you know, can we use the word allegations still, or is it?
Yes, he was not. Ray Holmberg was not
convicted.
Was not convicted of assault, and mm-hmm. he was not convicted of rape, and he was not convicted of having sex with a minor.
No,
he pled guilty to one count of traveling with the intent.
Yes,
of having sex with a minor, which was the subject of today's hearing.
Yes.
So that is something I do want to get into. I'm just going to remind you, you're listening to a special live edition of Main Street. I'm Ann Ahlquist, the director of radio. I'm here in our studios with Danielle Webster, and we've spent the bulk of the day at the sentencing hearing at the downtown Fargo courthouse of Ray Holmberg, of course, the former state senator from Grand Forks, former chair of the Appropriations Committee. And the discussion today in the sentencing hearing was whether or not he should be allowed to count time served. He's been in Sherburne County Jail in Minnesota,
Elk River, I believe.
Yeah,
yep.
and so the debate in front of the judge today was whether or not he should get 37 months, which is what the acting U.S. attorney would like to see, or if given circumstances, his age, he's 81 years old.
Yes.
He had testimony from family. He's a father, his grandfather, uncle.
Mm-hmm.
He has constituents whom he's helped over the years. And so taking this into account into his sentencing hearing. So that is the topic of our discussion. As of this time, Danielle, you had to leave to come here because we're doing this live show. And the defense attorney was still making his case that Ray Holmberg's time served should be included, and that these factors of his age, his medical condition, his legacy, his body of work as a committed public servant and a mentor and a coach should be factored into.
And lack of criminal history, he
That's right.
wanted to bring up a lot.
But the U.S. attorney was arguing the opposite and was bringing 9 exhibits to bear about
mm-hmm.
a history that even the defense attorney acknowledged was promiscuous,
mm-hmm.
And called Mr. Holmberg a rake.
Yes, that he was. He did also use the word immoral. He said this is an immoral, promiscuous person. But again, you know, it's not illegal to be immoral or promiscuous. But, you know, the acting U.S. attorney, again, her name is Jennifer Poole. She had a lot to say about, you know, this is not a man who only did this a few times. He had a pattern of behavior of, you know, pretty much everywhere he went, they were able to find that he had been soliciting sex workers on a variety of different apps, dating apps, hookup apps, Craigslist, things like that. literally every single place that he traveled, he was looking for this. And the reason why he traveled to Prague was because he was looking for clients, or he would be the client that he was looking for, the sex workers that were going to be younger than he could find in the United States.
Although he did say, I mean, in the documents, I mean, Ray Holmberg, I mean, he did say he didn't know. He didn't know what the age of consent was.
Right. Well, he was under the impression that it was legal in Prague, so he could do it there. And that, you know, some of the young men that he would be talking to on the dating or the, you know, the apps or whatever, fully aware that they could say they were of legal age, even though they may not be, in which case, you know, does he know that, or is it...
What did he know as he was receiving the as he was receiving the massage with the happy ending as the one of the investigators. So that's another piece about this as part of the sentencing hearing was that the defense attorney brought an investigator, Chuck Anderson, to do his own investigative work as well, and brought in some testimony. And I think that was the other piece about this. I'll be honest with you, Daniel. It didn't really feel like a sentencing hearing.
No, it felt like a trial. It did.
Yeah.
It really did. Because it was a lot of, the witness was called, and then the victim impact statements were also read, which that's a sentencing thing. But yeah, like, you know, Jennifer Poole called her witness, the investigator, and then, you know, Mark Fries got his... I was like, oh, this is cross examination. I'm like, but is it a cross exam? Because this isn't a trial. I'm not that brushed up on my legal stuff, as I don't do this type of thing often. But I'm still kind of looking.
Well, and just to frame it up as well, why the staging of this?
Well, what are you referring to? Because I'm thinking of, you know, in the construction of the, you know, the investigation, like how they were determining like what he was trying to do in Prague. I mean, he was using email accounts in which he was using
an alias,
a fake name, an alias, and some of the language that he was using, you know, in those emails and in that correspondence was
they described it as racist, crude humor, and explicit sexual language.
Yes.
The reason I bring up about the feeling of it and why that it felt like I was watching a trial is because, of course, he signed a plea agreement. And yes, there were things that he admitted to in that plea agreement, to the one count of intent of traveling to have sex with a minor. But there was a whole pattern of behavior that was not on the record.
Right.
And so this allowed Acting U.S. Attorney Jennifer Poole, because it's public record. Well, now it's there. It is a public court document that she's introduced all these 9 exhibits with 9,000 pages of cyber chats. They put them all into a PDF with these 9,000 pages of cyber chats of end-to-end encryption. These are platforms, you know, that are, you know, that you can use to protect your identity, and I think that was the other piece about it that I was thinking about as I was watching it was on Jennifer Poole's part, which was to enter this in as evidence, even though it did not necessarily pertain to the specific count that he had pled guilty to.
And I think also to really, it's establishing the pattern of behavior of a person who they believe used his position to, you know, take advantage of people. The young men in Grand Forks that he was counseling at the high school, Ray Holmberg served as a guidance counselor at Grand Forks Central High School. And one of the victims, actually, when he wanted to get up and enter into the record, and we are not going to use his name because he asked that we don't do that, and you respect victims. But he just wanted to get up there, and it struck me because he, during the defense's, you know, cross-examining of Cassetta, the investigator, he was asking about, like, well, weren't these young men drug addicts and weren't they troubled in this way and didn't they have problems and weren't they criminals? And yes, and the young man gets up there and he says, you know what? Yes, I had a really horrible childhood and I had all these horrible things happen to me and I needed guidance and I needed help. And this was a person who told me he could help and he did, you know, he did look out for me and he was somebody I could look up to. And it
and
eventually.
I thought it was a really powerful moment when mm-hmm. he said, "I'm a human being."
Yes,
mm-hmm. and this is true.
And how dare? Yes,
and
it's
this
true.
Is what happened.
This
That's
is what
I'm,
happened.
I'm reading from my notes.
Yes, he yeah. did say that. And
I mean, and people were tearing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a very poignant moment when Special Agent Cassetta.
Oh God! Yes. Well, it's tough stuff. It is.
Brought him a box of tissues.
Yes.
As he was testifying.
Because he did pause for quite a while, and you could have heard a pin drop. It would have sounded like a, you know, an anvil falling to the ground. It was just deathly quiet in there. But yeah, I mean, just he got up. He wanted to tell his version of what happened and make that impact statement and how what had happened to him impacted his entire life. I mean, he talked about, you know, yes, I did move to the West Coast. He lived up in Spokane, Washington. Yes, I did get involved in sex work because I was very damaged. I was addicted
to
drugs.
For
I
meth.
Needed you.
Spokane actually is known as the meth capital
yes.
of Washington State.
And there are things that you decide to do in order to get your drugs because you need your drugs because you don't want to feel this way anymore. So that was.
We've got 3 minutes left. You're listening mm-hmm. to a special live edition of Main Street. I'm Ann Ahlquist. Daniel Webster, one of our longtime reporters, we spent the whole morning, now half the afternoon, in the sentencing hearing for Ray Holmberg, sharing with you the most up-to-date information. I met a marshal on the way out as I was coming yeah. back to the station who said he's never seen anything like this. He's been to a lot of sentencing hearings. They may be an hour and a half, at the most 2 hours. And so this was a very special case, which is why we're doing Main Street Live, is because this is a very special event. So we've got a couple of minutes left, Danielle. Where did we leave it before you toss it to 10?
Oh, I was, I just wanted to add to, you know, as I left the courtroom about 50 minutes ago, and Mark Fries was still discussing, you know, his thoughts on the sentencing. He's recommending time served and treatment and whatnot. And as far as I know, I mean, I just checked my phone. I'm not seeing that anything's been announced quite yet, but we will be watching for that this afternoon. We will be bringing that news to you as soon as we hear it. And that's what's been happening today in downtown Fargo at the federal courthouse.
Thanks for listening to this special edition of Main Street Live from Prairie Public on the sentencing hearing of Ray Holmberg. As Danielle said, we've got Prairie Plates coming up, and we'll have regularly scheduled half hour of Main Street, including some interesting food, interesting Rick Guillen analysis of food. Thanks for tuning in.
I like bagels.
There's that music we look forward to every Wednesday here on Main Street. Of course, it means it's time for Prairie Plates with Rick Guillen. Rick, welcome back to Main Street.
It's good to be back with you, Craig. And we're going to talk a little bit more healthy lifestyle today.
Absolutely.
Last week was corned beef and cabbage and fish fries. So a little on the heavy side. So we're switching it up this week.
Earlier this week, we had herbalist Bevan Cohen with us, and that was a fun interview to have. Today, we have a special guest, Erin Oberlander. She's a holistic lifestyle coach, folk herbalist, certified aromatherapist, and fifth-generation North Dakotan. From Mott in southwest North Dakota, she empowers others to take charge of their health through herbalism, natural remedies, and a deep connection to the land. Erin, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
Your journey into herbalism began with your own health struggles, Erin, as I understand your story. Can you share more about what drew you to alternative medicine when conventional approaches just weren't helping?
Yes, and I think my story is relatable to many people out there. I, over 20 years ago, had always had a very vibrant health, never really had any health issues, never had any mental health issues. And suddenly one day my health just started spiraling downwards. I started experiencing symptoms I'd never had before. And I went to my doctor that I loved dearly and trusted deeply, and she ran all the labs. And as happens to many of us, all the labs came back normal. But I knew that I wasn't feeling right in my own skin anymore. And so I started to research and I started to learn and I started to get back in touch with seasonal living and growing my own food and my own herbs in my backyard in Fargo, in fact, and really started to find a way back to health through natural remedies, through herbalism, through aromatherapy, and lots of other holistic lifestyle stuff. And biohacking over the years has been a big part of my journey as well.
You grew up close to nature, really, on your family's farmland near Mott. How did that early connection to land influence now your work that you do with herbs and natural healing?
Yes. So I grew up as one of those kids that got let out in the morning to go play on the prairie and in the forest and came back for meals. And those were really my happiest times. And some of my most vibrant memories are times in nature, looking at the bugs and watching the clouds and seeing the seasons change and watching different things grow. And then I helped my mom in the garden and raising the animals and canning the food growing up as well. So I really learned how to subsist off the land. Well, then after I left home and I went to college and I went to the big city, like so many of us do, I lost that connection. And I really think that that's part of the reason why my health started to go downhill.
Go ahead.
Yes. And so getting back in touch with that has really helped me to learn that my body is part of nature, and learning to live within the cycles of nature has been really the foundation of my work and something that I teach my apprentices now as well.
You've amassed really a large following on Instagram and TikTok. And has social media helped or challenged your mission to promote a more healthy, natural lifestyle?
All of the above. It is a smorgasbord of different types of people and perspectives out there, but it's also given me an amazing platform to help to raise awareness for people about how simple it can be just to walk into their kitchen and make some things that are really helpful to help to support their body.
Rick, I have one more question, then I'll turn you loose on our good friend Aaron Oberlander. Aaron, you say that you like to rewild. What does rewild mean? You're a rewilder.
So the rewilding movement is something that became to be popular a few years back. And it was really people starting to not just grow their own food and do the modern homesteading thing, but also things like foraging and things like hunting. And I really feel like if you want to get to the real raw wildness of your food again and experience just the potency that you can get from things that are collected or hunted, that's really where it's at. So getting back in touch with those sort of life ways of what our ancestors did to that extent has been a huge part of my work and has really informed me in terms of like what my ethics are around the types of foods that I eat and the types of foods that I choose.
Aaron, when we had Chef Candace on a few weeks ago, and Chef Candace, Native American chef here in Fargo, we talked about food as medicine. And I know that you take that to heart, and you actually have some special diets that you've had for quite a while, a gluten-free diet. You eat a lot of, natural vegetables, garden vegetables, and you actually hunt your own deer. You forage your eggs on your farm. Can you talk about how food is medicine to you?
Man, that's such a deep question, because really so many people are finding their identity in the food that they eat. Like, they identify as a vegan or they identify as gluten-free, which means that our food has a lot deeper meaning than just what's on our plate. And I think that if you look at Eastern medicine and the chakra system, and nourishment is really our survival. It's like the foundation of who we are. It's what keeps us going. It's what keeps us alive. So if our food is vibrant, if it's nutrient dense, we are going to be nourished body, soul, and spirit on a completely different level than if our food is dead and processed. And so that's part of it. But then also learning how to prepare your own food and how to gather your own food and grow your own food and hunt your own food is a whole other layer to this that gives you appreciation and reverence for what we have to enjoy and the abundance of nature, and that we live in relationship with nature. There's reciprocity there. When we care for nature, nature cares for us back, and it's really a beautiful thing.
Erin, you have a degree in music. Where does that fit in with your balance that you want to achieve in life?
I know, Craig. I asked myself that same thing for a long time. Yes, I have a doctorate in music from NDSU. Amazing experience there. I actually built my business alongside of studying for my doctorate. These things are not mutually exclusive for me because plant medicine, aromatherapy, all of these things are about the whole body and the whole person. And really, music is too. And you realize that when you study something deeply. So when I really went all in on my business, I was like, okay, well, where does this music piece fit in now? Because I was no longer teaching at the college level. And I found sound healing. I found healing sound, sound baths, different frequencies, different instruments that have been used throughout human history to help to balance the body and bring mindfulness and help people to relax on a really deep level, which is so important when we're in this world where we're all chronically stressed all the time. And so along with my apprenticeships and my courses and my one-on-ones with people, I also offer healing sound to all those groups of people, because if our nervous system is dysregulated, it doesn't matter how nourishing our food is, our body can't receive it. So music has really allowed me to bring an aspect into healing that I think is missed a lot of the time.
Let's get back to food a little bit and the herbal side of things. When people think of herbs, they think of basil, thyme, rosemary. There are a whole lot more out there, but explain to folks that herbs are not just for flavor, they're actually for health.
Yes. Okay, so if you look at our history, spices and herbs, but particularly spices, were some of the most expensive and most prized things on the planet. We actually had a trade route that developed because of this, because of the spice trade. And the reason that those things were so valuable is that they helped preserve the food back when we didn't have refrigeration. Well, what we now know is that the spices are effective because they contain volatile oils and other compounds within them that are extremely potent and have actions inside the body as well. So when we look at something like a cayenne pepper, for example, we might just think, oh, that's to make something super spicy. But it also has the action of boosting your immunity, of stoking your digestive fire, of bringing down inflammation. And so there's so many more things going on when you season your food than just what's happening with the flavors in your mouth.
Are there any herbs that you'd recommend folks use?
I just think that whenever you're adding herbs to your food, add more than what the recipe calls for. Same with spice. The more herbs and spice that you can include in your cooking, the more you're going to see improvements in your digestion and your immunity. And this is a really simple, accessible way for us to get that kitchen medicine in.
And we had Greg Cook on, who you may know is a professor at NDSU, a chemistry professor. He's a vegan chef and owns a winery, 4E Winery.
Yes, I love 4E.
By the way, I agree with you about social media pages being a blessing and a curse, but they're a blessing for the most part. You have a gluten-free diet, and talk a little bit about that and how that's helped you over the years.
I had so many digestive issues that I could not get on top of. And I, you know, just through a long process, this is before anybody was really talking about this or before there was a lot of gluten-free stuff available, I finally figured out that it was the gluten. And it took me a while to fully release that because I'm the daughter of a wheat farmer, right?
Right.
So it took me a while to come to terms with that. But man, has my gut and my body been able to heal from that. Now, having said that, that's not something that's appropriate for anybody. And nutrition situation is so individual, and it also has to do with what our with our lineage and our ancestry. So being Scandinavian origin, I've learned that a lot of Scandinavians cannot digest gluten. And in fact, when I traveled to Sweden, one of the best things about being over there is that it was almost completely gluten-free. I really didn't have to worry about it, even in the bakeries. There is a lot of different aspects to what helps somebody to be healthy. And one of the things that I think is so important with this is to learn to tune into your own body and to really listen to what it's telling you and how you're feeling from the different things that you're eating.
Now that you've really learned a lot about natural approaches to your health, did you circle back with your doctor and share some of the lessons learned?
You know, I've since moved, so I don't have that same primary care, but my primary care here is amazing. And he's very open to a lot of these things and to the biohacking world as well. So when I go in and ask him for some crazy test that I want to try or tell him about something that I've been thinking about, we have really, really great conversations. And I think that I would love to see so much more of that. I learned so much from the allopathic side, and I think that there's, you know, if we could have more collaboration and more congenial exchanges, I think it would go a long ways towards helping people to have that full spectrum to draw upon when they're looking at different tools to help to support their health.
Aaron, have you ever been foraging and ate something and went, uh-oh, shouldn't have done that?
I have not, because I am really, really careful. However, we started growing our own mushrooms last year, and there is like a threshold, I think, sometimes with medicinal mushrooms that happens where you're eating them and it's fine. And then all of a sudden your body tells you, nope, I'm done. So we had that experience with some mushrooms. I can't remember the name of them right now.
I would guess that they're lion's mane, because I have that same issue with lion's mane.
Yes. Billy as well. My husband as well with lion's mane. My brother-in-law grows mushrooms all year round, and he gave us some lion's mane, which I love. And I was cooking it up, and my husband came in the house and he's like, what is going on? Like, he was just repelled even from the smell of it. And that is something that I would say, if you're taking supplements, if you're adding herbs that are new to you, and you're like having a visceral reaction like that, this is a survival instinct. Your body's telling you, this is maybe not for me right now. And a lot of times you'll hear people say, oh, it's all detox. And there absolutely is an act of detox that can happen with certain protocols and things that you would do. But I'm talking about like that initial reaction where you're like, this doesn't taste right. This doesn't smell right. This doesn't feel right. Listen to yourself.
And you're right on that. And I'm a forager, you know that. And coming up here is going to be ramps, which are basically like spring onions, and they're great. But on the mushroom front, it'll be morel season, which I'm fine with. Black and blonde morels, which grow in the Missouri River bottoms and then in western Minnesota quite a bit. Chanterelles are big getting into July and August. And bullets are good, too. But for me, chicken of the woods, I get a bad headache and a little bit
really?
Of and I get a little bit of nausea, which is too bad because Greg Cook loves them. He fries them up like mushroom nuggets, like chicken nuggets, and he loves them. And so, I don't know. You just really have to watch those personal reactions.
Again, nutrition is individual. Our bodies all have a different, from Eastern medicine standpoint, a different balance of the elements. And so something that works for me is not going to work for the next person. And that's why learning a little bit of that perspective can be so helpful, even when it comes to something like foraging and understanding, like, why can't I eat this thing this other person can? It's okay. It's just that's your body's needs.
Aaron, where can people learn more about your work?
So almost all of my work is completely online, and they can find me at herbsoilsandsound.com and on pretty much every social platform at Herbs, Oils, and Sound.
I was just going to say, check her out on the gram.
Our guest today has been Aaron Oberlander. She's a holistic life coach, a folk herbalist, certified aromatherapist, and fifth generation North Dakotan from Mott in southwest North Dakota. Aaron, it has been a pleasure.
Yes, likewise. Thank you so much.
Rick, it's always great to visit with you. Have a great week, my friend.
Mott is the spot where the pheasants are hot. We'll talk to you next week, Craig.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 26th.
there was a hint of panic when three cases of polio were reported in Fargo in 1921. The Ward County newspaper warned, "It is certain that the disease will spread over the state at an early date." Polio was the most feared disease in the United States, and for good reason. Polio was the leading cause of disability in children. It was highly contagious and terrified parents. Victims could end up in a wheelchair for life, with as many as 40% of survivors suffering permanent damage. In the worst cases, a polio survivor could end up in an iron lung because they couldn't breathe on their own. At the first hint of polio in a neighborhood, people avoided crowds. Parents were careful not to let their children play with others who had a runny nose, as the early stages of polio resembled a bad cold. Summer became known as polio season. Public swimming pools were closed, moviegoers were urged to sit apart, and insurance companies began selling polio insurance for newborns. The first polio epidemic in the U.S. hit Vermont in 1894, and an even bigger outbreak occurred in New York City in 1916. Polio cases regularly spiked to epidemic levels in the 1940s and 50s. While some diseases, like tuberculosis, had a higher death rate, the fear of paralysis in children was especially terrifying. Dr. Jonas Salk had been working on a vaccine to prevent polio. He even tested it on himself and his family. On this date, in 1953, Dr. Salk announced he had successfully developed a vaccine that was effective in preventing the disease. Just the year before, there were 58,000 new cases of polio in the U.S., and more than 3,000 people died from it. Salk's announcement was hailed as a miracle. After the vaccine became widely available, new polio cases dropped to under 6,000 by 1957. The World Health Organization set a goal to eradicate polio globally, and they're getting very close. In 2012, there were fewer than 200 cases of polio worldwide. The United States hasn't seen a death from polio in decades. The National Institutes of Health credits Dr. Salk and his vaccine for that incredible achievement. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hey, kids in kindergarten through the fifth grade, get ready to write and illustrate a story for Prairie Public's PBS Kids Writers Contest. Why? Well, because writing is fun, and you can win some great prizes. Oh, and you'll want to tell your teachers all about it, because if they submit their student stories, they are entered to win gift certificates themselves. Yeah, it's a win-win for everybody, so get out your markers and get cracking today. The deadline to submit your story is March 31st. You can find entry forms, complete rules, and details at prairiepublic.org. The 2025 PBS Kids Writers Contest. Have fun and good luck.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at starianbank.com.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As the country looks for new energy sources, indigenous communities are sounding the alarm on the potential risks of nuclear power. Arizona Mirror reporter Sean Dean Silversmith traveled a 320-mile uranium haul transportation route, speaking to indigenous communities along the way about their concerns. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to her about the experience.
Can you tell us a little bit about the uranium haul route and what you heard from indigenous people along the way?
The uranium haul route is the approved hauling route that Energy Fuels Inc., which owns and operates the Pinyon Plain mine near the Grand Canyon, has the rights to be able to transport uranium ore from their mine traveling along that route to their processing mine near Blanding, Utah. A lot of the concerns surrounding the transportation are obviously concerns around safety of the transportation, the containment of the uranium ore, and just overall concerns about contamination. Here's Havasupai traditional practitioner Diana Sue Ukwala.
This is all medicine. And when I look at that, I'm overwhelmed because these are going to die. They're not going to exist, or we can't use it anymore because of the contamination.
Since your series came out, there's been an agreement between the Navajo Nation and Energy Fields. What are the details of that agreement, and what reactions have you heard?
The agreement between Energy Fuels and the Navajo Nation came out at the end of January, probably January 29th. But the thing is, they haven't made the full agreement public. And the Navajo Nation can't make that agreement public either because the Navajo Nation signed an NDA.
The most heartbreaking part is that our own government doesn't have our back.
That was Leona Morgan, the co-founder for the grassroots group called No. But these negotiations were only done between the Navajo Nation and Energy Fuels. You have the Havasupai tribe, who was really disappointed in the Navajo Nation and Energy Fuels cutting them out of these talks. The other tribe that responded was the Ute Mountain Ute tribe, and that is only 5 miles away from the White Mesa Mill, which is where this uranium ore is being transported. This is Ute Mountain Ute tribal member and White Mesa community advocate Yolanda Badback.
It's like they don't have respect for us indigenous people.
You have had a lot of community members who live along the haul route who have come out against this agreement, but it's in place and they are actively hauling tons of uranium ore from the Pinon Plain mine every day. The Navajo Nation doesn't own the right-of-ways of the highway along the route, so they can't stop them. They have been indicating their next best option was developing an agreement, and that's what they did.
The uranium push is all happening in the bigger context of a national transition away from fossil fuels toward alternate energy sources like nuclear. What are you hearing from indigenous communities about how this is impacting them?
I know other advocates who are trying to educate the Navajo Nation about what this hauling of the uranium ore actually means, because if this is one step that they can take, well, what's going to stop them from trying to start mines within the Grand Canyon or look for other ways to access those critical resources that impact indigenous communities? And now that we are in an administration that is actively trying to find ways to unleash American energy and find ways to access alternative energy, they are going to look at public land sources. Here's former Navajo Nation Cameron Chapter Vice President Candice Yazzie.
They're choosing the profit over the people. You know, it's going through tribal communities, which is why not many heads are being turned.
I think one of the things that I heard from the residents in White Mesa on the Ute Mountain Ute tribe is that they don't want to have to relocate. They don't have anywhere else to go.
That was Sean Dean Silversmith, who reports on tribal nations for the Arizona Mirror. You can read her series at azmirror.com. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
The Fargo Moorhead Symphony Orchestra presents Cartoon Capers, a family concert of cartoon and Disney favorites, Saturday, April 5th at 2 p.m. at the Fargo Theater. Arrive early for the musical instrument petting zoo. Details at fmsymphony.org.